I next met with Dr. Bakai Saab to review the cases of colorectal cancer presented at the symposium. And to begin, he commented on a 71-year-old woman who presented with metastatic RAS wild-type disease, and about two-thirds of the audience would use bevacizumab and chemotherapy, mainly FOLFOX, but almost a quarter of the audience would use chemotherapy and an anti-EGFR antibody in the patient. I asked Dr. Saab about these two approaches.
I don't think there's much of a difference between an EGFR inhibitor and a VEGF inhibitor in the first line added to chemotherapy. And I tend to favor the VEGF inhibitor, specifically bevacizumab, with chemotherapy. And the reason for that is specifically focused on the toxicities. The toxicity profile is a little different. You know, bevacizumab drives mostly hypertension, which is controllable. You know, there are some rare complications with it, incredibly rare. But with cetuximab, you know, about 10% of the patients will have significant rash. I mean, we're talking about painful and necessitating stop of drug and increased diarrhea. So you have these toxicities that could certainly affect quality of life. And again, if you look at the study, they suggest probably not as much as we think they do. But nonetheless, we always have the option of going back to the EGFR inhibitors in the second and third line to provide salvage for these patients. So I don't see any necessity to change the current standard and move away from bevacizumab to cetuximab. Although I do believe that, you know, with all the data that's arising, it tells us that both cetuximab and panitumumab are valid companions to chemotherapy. And for some that prefer to use them in the first line, it's acceptable. My preference is not.
So given that the majority of the audience uses FOLFOX or CAPOX with bevacizumab up front in a patient like this, we asked them what their approach to maintenance was. And the vast majority say they do use maintenance and they use 5-FU and bevacizumab. What is your approach? And what about the issue of, it really comes down to the oxaliplatin, of stopping at a defined number of cycles as opposed to sort of waiting until the patient has symptoms and then flipping them into the maintenance phase.
And I think that's probably the key factor in determining, you know, how you want to proceed with first-line therapy, especially that we have these patients living for a long time now. My default actually is to use FOLFIRI, but regardless, in some patients I do use FOLFOX. And I use the Optimox approach. And the reason for that is, you know, across the years, data suggests that, frankly, beyond 3 months of oxaliplatin, there is very little evidence that you benefit the patient beyond the first 3 months of chemotherapy in terms of plateauing the response and the progression-free survival. And Optimox 1 and Optimox 2 study came with a conclusion that it's both safer, so the regimens would be more tolerable if we give patients a stop on the oxaliplatin at 3 months, but it doesn't seem like you compromise their outcome. Meaning, in other words, by doing a stop-and-go approach, giving the oxaliplatin for 3 months versus to progression, you actually still have those patients surviving equally well, having very similar progression-free survival, not affecting the response rate, but you cut down significantly on their neurotoxicity and neutropenia and other toxicities, and thrombocytopenia, by the way, which grade 3 thrombocytopenia is a big deal with FOLFOX given beyond 3 to 4 months. So my approach in clinic is whenever using FOLFOX, oh, we tend to give FOLFOX plus bevacizumab over 3 months and then take it down to 5-FU bevacizumab for maintenance.
So in continuing this case discussion, it turns out that the patient actually was given FOLFOX Bev, but the patient experienced a severe allergic reaction which seemed to be related to the oxaliplatin. I think the patient was challenged again with another course, had the same severe allergic reaction, and was then switched to FOLFIRI Bev, followed by 5-FU and Bev maintenance. First, just a question about this issue of oxaliplatin allergy. Have you observed it, and how do you usually deal with patients who have this problem?
So hypersensitivity reactions from oxaliplatin are actually more common than one would think. And it's not specific to oxaliplatin, it's a platinum issue. You know, most platinums, when you use them for the long term, and in oxaliplatin, usually after the 7th or 8th dose of oxaliplatin is when you start increasing the risk of hypersensitivity. You do see it in a small percent of patients, I'd say about 5 to 10% if we actually use it even for longer. And then it can go from the mild reaction to the more severe reaction. And mild reactions, you know, just mild hypersensitivity, some itching perhaps, to the severe reactions where patients actually can have decompensation and essentially may collapse, which is incredibly rare. The first thing you do is you assess, of course, the severity of the reaction and you act on it. But if a patient experiences these hypersensitivity reactions, typically what we do, we pre-medicate them a little bit more aggressively with Benadryl and steroids, etc., and we prolong the infusion. If it's very mild, you can just get away with prolonging the infusion without adding much. So typically it's 2 hours, you can go to three. We've actually stretched it to the limit of 5 hours infusion of oxaliplatin in some patients who never responded well to these maneuvers. Occasionally with more severe reactions, we've used epinephrine. And there are a couple of studies actually that looked at the value of using epinephrine along with other pre-medications before administering oxaliplatin. And then, of course, for those patients who had a significant reaction to the point, you know, where they had to be either on oxygen or intubated, we discontinued the oxaliplatin because it'd be too risky to continue with oxaliplatin. So you see a variety of different reactions, but it's more common than one would think. And again, it happens usually after 4 to 5 months of oxaliplatin.
So this patient found it to be a very unpleasant experience. I don't think she wants to receive that again. And in fact, she was treated with FOLFIRI-BEV and then 5-FU-BEV maintenance and responded and did well. And then 14 months later had disease progression. She didn't have any new symptoms. It was more on imaging. So we asked the audience at that point, what would you do? And here it was split. Everyone would use some type of irinotecan regimen, but about two-thirds of the audience would use that with an EGFR antibody, and about a quarter would just use it with a BEV. So this patient hasn't had irinotecan now in some time when the relapse has occurred, and it seems as though most would want to start it back. A few wanted to go with aflibercept. Again, how do you think through, in general, the situation of a patient who's progressing on chemo/BEV?
So the data supports the concept of VEGF inhibition beyond VEGF inhibition failure. In other words, you know, continuing the bevacizumab or switching to aflibercept, you know, would both be reasonable options, although I'll tell you what my thoughts are on this. And I think it's also very reasonable to proceed with an EGFR inhibitor. I mean, the data really supports all these strategies. So the question is really, how do you make up your mind about which one to use since there is data relatively supporting the two approaches? So clearly, the default or the preference is, you know, work with the devil you know rather than the devil you don't know. So, you know, patients have been on bevacizumab, they've done well. You know, and this situation is a little bit more complex because, you know, the patients had been on Oxali and IRI, but typically they're on one line of therapy before they progress and go on a different line of therapy. So switching the chemotherapeutics, such as was shown on the TML study, and maintaining the same biologic, bevacizumab, would induce a benefit both in survival and progression-free survival. We also know from the Velour study that with aflibercept beyond bevacizumab progression in 30% of the patients, that you again maintain a progression-free survival advantage and perhaps an overall survival advantage. And then now we know that the same is true with ramucirumab, another VEGF inhibitor. Actually, it's a VEGF receptor 2 inhibitor. So that concept now is well established. We can continue inhibiting VEGF beyond VEGF inhibition. Now, if you look at all these studies, the deltas are very similar. So one would really think that there is no real advantage to go to aflibercept or ramucirumab and frankly just continue with, like I said, the devil you know, i.e. bevacizumab, just continue with it through and just switch the chemotherapy backbone. Now, why you would consider an EGFR inhibitor instead in this situation and specifically coupled with an irinotecan? The response rate is likely to be higher in the second or third line when you add an EGFR inhibitor such as cetuximab or panitumumab to irinotecan. And we see response rates such as with the 181 study with FOLFIRI panitumumab up to 30% versus, you know, FOLFIRI alone about 10%. And even if you look at the TML, FOLFIRI plus bevacizumab, 4%. So we know we can induce a stronger response in the refractory setting with the addition of an EGFR inhibitor, although the delta on survival and progression-free survival are very similar. In other words, if you have a patient who's becoming very symptomatic from their cancer burden, it would make a lot of sense to switch them to an EGFR inhibitor then. If they're not, and they continue, which is a lot of our patients, and they continue to be mostly asymptomatic, not a lot of disease burden or symptoms from the cancer, then I think it would make more sense just to continue with the bevacizumab and switch the chemotherapeutic.
So you mentioned ramucirumab, and obviously that's getting a lot of attention related to gastric cancer. What do we know about ramucirumab and colon cancer?
We know that ramucirumab added to FOLFIRI in second line versus FOLFIRI alone in patients who failed chemotherapy plus bevacizumab in the first line. So this study was designed to have all patients exposed to bevacizumab in the first line fail bevacizumab plus chemotherapy, and then at progression they go to receive either FOLFIRI or FOLFIRI ramucirumab. It was a placebo-controlled study. And what this study suggests is that there was a survival benefit. It was along the same lines of what we've seen with the Velour study and the same lines we've seen with the TML study, this magic 1.4 to 1.8 month delta on survival and an advantage in survival. So it reproduced very similar results than the aflibercept study and the bevacizumab TML study. So we know that this is an added option. The question, of course, is how does it fit in the landscape? I mean, we got a lot of Me Too VEGF inhibitors now. There doesn't seem to be, at least historically, any advantage of one versus the other.
Do you see a role in your practice for ramucirumab?
I don't see any particular role, the same way I didn't see a significant role for aflibercept in our patient population, for the same reasons that I stated, is that, you know, the advantage seems to be very similar to the advantage you see with just continuation of bevacizumab. And so I don't see a strong case to make a switch of the biologic at progression, at least with the same class of biologics.
So going on to the next case, we get into the issue of more advanced disease. And the patient was a 74-year-old man. KRAS mutant rectal cancer, has received multiple lines of systemic therapy for metastatic disease, mainly involving the lung. And the patient kind of got beyond approved therapies or the initial approved therapies. And in this case, the decision was made to start regorafenib. And a lot of the what happened with the case really relates to once the patient got started, which I'll talk to you about in a second. But just sort of taking a step back, though, can you talk about what we've learned about regorafenib in the advanced disease setting, particularly the so-called CONCUR trial, a phase 3 study similar to the initial CORRECT study that was done? The CONCUR study was done in Asian patients. What was seen in that study and how it sort of lined up with the data that had been seen previously with CORRECT, and overall what your take is on what the benefits of therapy are potentially in this situation?
So CONCUR study really was, as you said, in Asian patients, following a very similar design than the prior study, the CORRECT study. Again, a 2-to-1 randomization to regorafenib, and they used 160 milligram dose daily or placebo. And again, it was given 3 weeks on, 1 week off, so 4 week cycle. So very similar design. Patients must have had more than two prior standard treatments, et cetera. So really, it was designed as a confirmatory study in an Asian patient population. And indeed, this study, again, another, so this is the second phase 3 study, albeit it was a smaller study, but it was the second phase 3 study that did confirm that regorafenib actually improves outcome versus placebo. You know, the problem remains the same. The hand and foot skin reaction, grade 3, or more, was still significant with regorafenib. It was more than 16%. So still along the same lines that we've seen with the first study. Hypertension was significant. And again, when they looked at most subgroups, there was not much difference between the subgroups. Most of them did seem to benefit, whether they were exposed to prior VEGF or prior EGFR. So, you know, this particular study, you know, just confirmed the results of the first regorafenib study. that this is a valid option for patients who progressed after standard therapies. But the problem remains the same, the problem of significant toxicities, specifically hand and foot syndrome and fatigue, which ends up being one of the limiting factors for the utilization of this agent in patients with refractory colorectal cancer.
So a couple of questions we asked the audience sort of relative to the issue of the use of regorafenib. First is initial dosing, and it's kind of split. It looks like most of the audience, when they do use the drug, use it at a reduced dose, although about a quarter use it at the approved dose, at least as a starting dose of 160 milligrams a day, 21 out of 28 days. How do you approach in your own practice whether to use the drug? Maybe you can describe a situation where you might use it or might not use it. And then what about initial dosing?
Yeah, so, you know, I actually do give regorafenib consideration for all my patients when they actually fail all standard therapies, talking about, you know, FOLFOX, FOLFIRI, bevacizumab, if they are RAS wild-type EGFR inhibitors. And then, to be frank, I usually look at a reasonable clinical trial first, even phase one trials, before I consider this option of regorafenib. But ultimately, you know, this option is considered for most patients. And unfortunately, again, when patients get to this line of therapy, many of them may not be in good shape enough to pursue this agent. But I do give it consideration. And now to the question of dose, this is a challenging question. Because if you ask, you know, 10 oncologists in a room, you will never get the same answer from all 10 oncologists. Everyone does a little bit differently. Some, like myself, start with 160, and I'll tell you why I think, for now at least, this is what we should do. And others, you know, like my friend Axel Grothy, tends to start with a lower dose and escalate within 4 weeks to reach the 160. Most patients, 80% or so, will end up on a dose of 120 or less. 20% will actually remain at the 160, which makes the case to start with a lower dose reasonable. My problem with that, though, is we are talking about patients who have an average lifespan of close to 4 months, 4 or 5 months, who are likely to be on regorafenib for an average of 2 months. And so when you think about it, you don't have a lot of time to experiment with a dosage question that has never been looked at in a clinical trial. So I personally have difficulties in terms of taking the leap of faith and just start someone on a lower dose that we have no certainty that it's going to be the right dose for the patient, at least from the trial. So to address that, actually, we have initiated a trial through Accrue. So myself and Axel Grothy, we've initiated a trial that's actually going to address that question. That's a phase two, a large phase two randomized trial that's going to look at starting a dose of 160 versus escalating the dose on a weekly basis from 80 to 160 in those who can tolerate it in the first 4 weeks. This study is going to have an acronym called REDOS, R-E-D-O-S. And hopefully it will help us figure out whether the strategy of dose escalation is better than starting from 160.
So we also asked the audience in their own experience when they see side effects, particularly hand-foot syndrome. Most said they saw it early in the course, in the first few weeks of treatment. Is that what you've observed? And do you do anything preemptively to prevent side effects, particularly hand-foot syndrome? What do you do if they do develop side effects?
So the hand and foot syndrome, unlike with sorafenib, with regorafenib, tends to happen in the first 2 to 3 weeks. And when it happens and it's severe, severity actually is very obvious in the first 3 weeks of the drug administration. So it happens very quickly. In terms of can you do anything preemptively, there are no validated strategies right now to actually help understand what would help prevent hand and foot syndrome other than keep the hand moisturized and essentially the cuticles taken care of, etc. So, you know, hand hygiene and hand moisturizing and fingernails are being taken care of. You know, other than these strategies, there is really no known preemptive strategy. There are some strategies that are being looked at, mostly applying steroid creams to the hands and the feet prior to initiating regorafenib. These were looked at with other TKI inhibitors as well. The data is unfortunately, you know, on a small number of patients. Actually, as part of our study, we are looking at this preemptively versus reactively. Now, what do we do reactively? I mean, depending on the severity of the hand and foot syndrome, if it's less severe, we typically just enhance the education to keep the hands and the feet moisturized, etc., and continue with the agent. If actually it's significant, we tend to stop the drug and then apply those measures and then go back on a reduced dose of the drug, usually to the lower dose level. And then if it's severe, meaning grade 3 or more, depending on the severity, we may actually discontinue the drug. And that's the case in a small percent of patients where we have to discontinue the drug. And it's not just the hand and foot syndrome. Usually it comes also with significant fatigue. So the patients are incredibly debilitated with the fatigue alongside with the hand and foot syndrome.
So we also asked the audience to tell us about the last patient in their practice who died of colorectal cancer and whether they received Regorafenib. And about half of the patients in that situation described by the audience did receive it. What would you think you would see in your own practice if you looked at it in that regard? And what are the kinds of patients who end up receiving it? And have you seen patients have benefits, the clinical benefits that you could detect?
Yeah, so I would say that it's probably a little bit less than 50% in my practice. And part of that has to do with the fact that, you know, in an academic practice like ours, we probably have a number of phase one trials that the patients may go through first. But I believe the 50%, and it may be a little bit less than that. I do believe that the reason why the other 50 do not receive it is because of reluctance or because the patients are too ill to receive it. So in terms of do we see any benefit from this agent? I mean, in my practice, I'd say 2 to 3 out of every 10 patients may have some benefit, and perhaps in 1 out of 10 patients, the benefit can be surprisingly solid. You know, I can give you anecdotally a couple of patients that I recently saw back in my clinic that have started Regorafenib about a year ago, and they're still on it. Their CA dropped significantly, actually, one of them to undetectable level. The CT scan response tends to be not as impressive, but they have tolerated the treatment well. One actually stayed under the 160, the other one went down to 120, and they both have been doing reasonably well. I mean, those are the two that probably have done the best so far, tolerating it well. The first patient that I had to drop to 120 developed some significant hand and foot syndrome and eventually resolved and restarted him at 120, and he did great. And the one that went on 160, she actually did extremely well on the treatment from day one. Her CA actually is undetectable, although the scans, and I stopped doing them at this point of time because this is her last option anyways, but her initial scans didn't show a significant response, maybe a little bit of shrinkage, but her CA definitely normalized.
I was going to ask you before, what's your usual initial follow-up plan on a patient you just started on Regorafenib? When do they come back to clinic? Do you have the nurses call them? What's your immediate plan?
So in the first 4 weeks, actually, we have them come back every week to see the nurse practitioner. They see me at week 4 before reinitiating Regorafenib after a week break. But I see them just before their first month of treatment and then just before their second month of treatment. And the first month of treatment, they come weekly to be assessed by the nurse practitioner. Frankly, they can also be assessed by a nurse by phone midway rather than bring them, and that's acceptable as well. After the second month, I think I'm comfortable then having them come every 4 weeks, because most of the toxicities, as you know, your audience told you, most of the toxicities you really see, the significant ones, you really see in the first 3 to 4 weeks. So this is where you really need to keep a hawk's eye on them. And after those 4 weeks pass by, I think you become very comfortable in every 4 weeks follow-up.
So another case that we had presented was a 49-year-old man, KRAS mutant metastatic colorectal cancer, status post multiple lines of systemic therapy, including Regorafenib. And the patient was viewed to be still interested in further therapy. Condition was pretty good. And what the doc wanted to know is, what about TAS-102, a new agent that's not yet approved? What is it? Is it likely to become available? And if so, where might it be used? We actually asked the audience, most of the audience wasn't even familiar with TAS 102, but of those who were familiar with it, most of them would use it, the vast majority, if it were available. And they're kind of split. Some would use it before regorafenib or after. Of course, it might depend upon the approval. But what is TAS 102 and where do you think it might be heading?
So TAS 102 is likely to be approved soon. So we'll talk about that. But TAS 102 is an interesting agent. You know, it's actually a new form of oral nucleoside. And unlike 5-FU, I think there's a lot of confusion about thinking that this is just another 5-FU. It's not. It's actually a thymidine analog trifluorothymidine, which essentially is a little different way to tackle the very similar pathway than what 5-FU does. But because of its structure, it actually has been shown, without delving into too much details, to bypass resistance pathways that typically take place when you expose tumors to 5-FU. And also the agent contains an application of thymidine phosphorylase inhibitor. You know, TP is an important enzyme in that pathway. And so with this TP inhibitor, it tends to actually increase the bioavailability of the active agent that I'll call TFT, so thymidine, analog trifluorothymidine. So the combination of the two is actually very potent and is thought to work when 5-FU fails and has perhaps even more potency. So a phase 3 study called the RECOURSE trial looked at TAS 102 versus placebo. In this trial, again, very similar design to the regorafenib trials, except, of course, in this one, since regorafenib is already available, this trial allowed patients to have prior exposure to regorafenib. And patients were randomized to receive TAS 102 or placebo. A relatively large study, 800 patients, 2-to-1, again, randomization. And then they found the hazard ratios to be very favorable to the TAS 102. With survival, it was 0.68, and with progression-free survival, it was 0.48, with p less than 0.0001. So very significant improvements in both overall survival and progression-free survival. Now, I think, interestingly, which is one of the reasons why one would start thinking about favoring TAS 102 in the clinical picture, is the safety results. You know, the safety results are relatively favorable because of the mechanism of action. You know, you don't see hand and foot syndrome in this. I mean, you always think about a fluoropyrimidine, right? You think about hand and foot syndrome. In this situation, no hand and foot syndrome reported, of course. There were some added toxicities, some added nausea, but it's mostly low grade. The one thing I probably would say is something that needs to be kept in mind is that patients on TAS 102 got febrile neutropenia. About 4% of them had febrile neutropenia. I mean, mostly grade 3, but it was febrile neutropenia. And that's because it's a cytotoxic agent rather than a cytostatic agent like regorafenib. So other than that, this agent seemed to actually have a significant benefit in progression-free survival and overall survival without significant toxicities. And I think places it very favorably in the landscape of how we treat colon cancer.
Any thoughts about how you think it's going to be used or approved and how you're going to use it?
So I think it's going to be approved for refractory colorectal cancer as a single agent. And I can tell you there are a lot of trials now looking at it in combination. So more to come in the future. But for now, once it gets approved, I suspect that it's probably going to use after failure of chemotherapy, of standard chemotherapies plus biologics. And I suspect for, as folks become more familiar with it, that it's likely going to be used before regorafenib and not after regorafenib. So before regorafenib, that's what I suspect. In my own practice, I will give it serious considerations even before I move to regorafenib. Before we figure out the exact dosing schedule of regorafenib, this one seems to provide at least an equal benefit in the same patient population and perhaps safer to use. And therefore, I do see an advantage to place it ahead of regorafenib in most patients.
You mentioned that it's being looked at in combination. What kinds of combinations are being looked at?
So there are a number of studies that are either in planning or I think already accruing, and that's TAS-102 plus irinotecan plus oxaliplatin, so the usual offenders, are trying to look at it, plus bevacizumab. There are also some other agents that are from the same company that are being looked at in combination. I think those are less interesting for colorectal cancer. But overall, just the usual standard looking TAS-102 in combination with traditional chemotherapeutics plus a VEGF inhibitor for now. I do not think that there are any looking at combination with EGFR inhibitors at this point of time, but I think those would be coming. So just looking at exactly the areas, there's also, I think, a study that's looking at TAS-102 plus regorafenib in metastatic colorectal cancer. So a lot more to come about this agent, and if it truly works better than 5-FU, at least hypothetically it may, we may see added advantages in the future when combining it with chemotherapy.
That's really interesting. So another case that we asked about, or that one of the docs asked about, was a 49-year-old lady. She was actually a firefighter who had a prior history of a colectomy for KRAS wild-type colon cancer and then presented, unfortunately, with unresectable liver mets, but in good condition, still working. She got FOLFOX-BEV, had a response, then had disease progression. The disease was still confined to the liver, still considered unresectable. And the patient was offered FOLFIRI-BEV along the strategy of what you had been talking about before, but she was feeling good and she really did not want to lose her hair. Again, she was very functional, was working, and just had gone through that experience of hair loss and found it very disturbing. And the patient herself, if you remember, had brought up the issue of liver-directed only therapy as a possibility. We actually asked the audience if the patient had said that to them, would they have used the liver-directed therapy? And the vast majority, almost 85%, said yes. And in fact, this patient had, at the time of the meeting, been just started on therapy with yttrium 90 microspheres. So I'd like to get your thoughts, first of all, about this case in general and whether you've had patients like this. And what about liver-directed therapy? At the meeting, we talked about the idea of the toolbox of all different types of liver-directed therapy that are available beyond surgery, including, for example, RFA, but also these microspheres. How do you think through this?
So in a patient such as this one, I still favor systemic therapy. However, I do respect the patient's request not to go through any more chemotherapy and proceed with local approaches. I think local approaches are reasonable as long as they are known to be effective in that setting. So in a patient that has multiple lesions that are unresectable, it's very difficult to think that RFA, so radiofrequency ablation, or stereotactic radiation, so SBRT, or other forms of very focused modalities would help. So someone like that would actually be a reasonable candidate for SIR-spheres, which are, you know, these tiny microspheres that get injected, radioactive beads that get injected into the liver. The only issue with SIR-spheres or with the microspheres overall is that there is no data, no really good data in colorectal cancer, at least when used as a single modality. There are reports here and there that do suggest that they may have some level of disease control in the liver, and I do believe they do. And whether that actually affects overall survival is questionable, although very possible since a lot of these patients die from liver failure. So I think, you know, rationally, reasonably, if a patient refuses chemotherapy and the disease is limited to the liver only and it's not amenable to radiofrequency ablation or SBRT or other modalities, then SIR-spheres are actually certainly a reasonable option. We've done SIR-spheres on a number of patients in our practice.
What's your experience with the patients that you have done this procedure on? How do they tolerate it, and what have you observed in terms of benefits?
So they do fairly well. Actually, we published our experience a few years ago in Clinical Colorectal Cancer. And what we've seen, what we've observed, is essentially that the only group of patients that seem to benefit from the application of SIR-spheres are those patients who had liver-limited disease. not liver dominant disease, because oftentimes, you know, we've had some in my practice have given it for liver dominant disease and others for, such as myself, just give it to liver limited disease. And it turns out that those with liver limited disease and no extra hepatic disease tend to actually benefit from it. The liver dominant disease, not as much, at least from our experience, and this is in the refractory setting. But even when you look at the overall group, you know, the benefit seems to be modest at most. And part of it could be also related to the fact that most of these patients were in their third line or fourth line setting. So, you know, a tough group to actually control.
Any comments about the phase 3 study that's looking at this treatment strategy, the so-called SIR-FLOX study, which is looking at FOLFOX plus or minus these spheres in liver-only disease or liver-dominant disease?
So this is actually a really good study. We finally have some results about this modality with chemotherapy. The results of the study will be presented at ASCO. But essentially, the study, and I would have predicted that in some ways, did show two things. One, and I'll tell you what I'm excited on waiting on. This wasn't reported, but what was reported are two parameters. One, progression-free survival between FOLFOX and FOLFOX plus the surf spheres, the difference was not significant. So they were very similar. So adding the liver modality to the systemic modality did not improve the progression-free survival. Remember, those are not liver only. But it was interesting when they looked at the liver progression-free measure. So when they looked at just the liver only, those patients who received the surf spheres had a delay in progression in their liver disease, which essentially is not surprising, right? I mean, you would expect a liver-directed modality, especially if you think it's relatively active, to control the liver disease, and that it did. And added to FOLFOX, it did better than FOLFOX alone. Now, right now, this doesn't change my mind about how to use this modality, and I probably wouldn't use it in the first line. But I'll tell you what I'm waiting on. I'm waiting on the survival results. Because I do believe if we're really making an impact on the liver disease, regardless whether this is liver-limited or liver-dominant in the first line, if we really are affecting the liver positively, then patients are less likely to die from liver failure on the long run, and therefore, we may actually affect their survival. So if the survival in the FOLFOX plus SIR spheres end up being higher, meaningfully higher than FOLFOX alone, that I think that it may be reasonable to consider this as an option for liver-only or liver-dominant disease.
So the results that you're talking about now have been through press release?
Yes.
And so nobody's actually seen the data, and there's going to be more presented, hopefully, at ASCO?
There will be more on ASCO, but we know from the press release that PFS is the same, and liver PF is much better with the SIR-FLOX plus FOLFOX, but no survival data, and even in the press release, was available at this time.
Anything else that we know in terms of tolerability of this therapy? You said that what you've seen is generally tolerable. When you do see problems, what kinds of problems do you see?
So mostly actually a very safe modality to give. The only two things we've seen are essentially transaminitis, so elevation of the liver function tests. And unfortunately, because those patients also had a significant disease burden in the liver, you know, eventually their liver failure, in the patients at least that we've had, could be attributable to just progression of disease in the liver rather than the SIR spheres. If you look at the earlier studies, they haven't seen that, but they've seen LFT elevations. The other thing that you see occasionally, duodenal ulcers and gastritis, and that's essentially from some of these microspheres translocating into gastric walls. But other than that, frankly, very, very few toxicities.
Subsequent to these interviews, on April 24th, 2015, Ramucirumab received FDA approval for use in combination with FOLFIRI for the treatment of patients with metastatic colorectal cancer whose disease has progressed during or after first-line therapy with bevacizumab, oxaliplatin, and fluoropyrimidine.